Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. We have a very interesting show for you tonight. In two parts, an hour-long show. The first part, we'll be talking to Kostas Mouzouras, who's directly responsible for my having learned how to taste wine, how to understand wine. He's the manager at Gotham Wines and Liquors in Manhattan on Broadway between 94 and 95th. He's a wine master par excellence. He's a walking encyclopedia on all matters wine. This evening, we will be talking about kosher wine and how it evolved from being the industry's laughingstock to where it's winning international awards in direct competition with the finest wines from all over the world. Good evening, Kostas.
Good evening, Chaim. And good evening, everybody.
It's a pleasure having you on the show, finally. Lord knows I've been trying to get you on the show for quite a while.
We have been trying for this for quite a while, you're right.
Yeah.
Busy schedule for both of us, so it's a good thing at the end of the day.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about how kosher wine evolved to where we are today.
Well, I was
give us a bit of history.
Yes, quite a bit of history. I was lucky not just simply experience it, but I believe being part of it. When I started officially with Gotham back in 1988, literally kosher wine was non-existent. We had very few brands. We had, of course, we're all standard Manischewitz. We had the Baron Herzog was at the market at the point of time. We had a few imports. Shapiro was still in business. I don't know if you remember those wines.
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I remember how they used to brag about their wine being so thick you could cut it with a knife.
Yeah, they're traditional stuff. But he was one of the first to branch out, and he actually had some Burgundy in the market. He had some other Bordeaux in the market. So it was very small selection, but it was existent. And I remember it was one of the first sections or areas that was assigned to me because I was new, I was very young, I was 19 when I started there, and it was a small responsibility. So, but I live through it, I see it, how it developed and what it became today, how the brand started coming little by little into the market. You went from having Gamla and Yarden from Israel, then a little by little introducing Tishbe, and then getting Weinstock from California. And before you know it, we had wines from all over the world. And all these Israeli names, that one after another, they made their introduction into the U.S. market. So I was lucky enough to be part of it and grow with it. So I feel very honored in that way. Maybe that's why kosher wine has a very soft spot in my heart.
Well, I am sure that you also were directly instrumental in bringing all those wines into America. I'm sure that you are part of the reason why the kosher palate has become so developed as far as wines are concerned. When I first came to this country in 1962, the choices of wine were extra sweet and even sweeter. Today, if I tried to drink those wines, it would kill me.
It will certainly will today. But I don't want to take credit for it, but we did, all of us as in the industry as retailers or people that actually sell the wine and talk to the consumer, we spoke with all these winemakers, and we did tell them what people want and that they want to have the same wine like everybody else, and they listened. So the credit is to them. They weren't, you know, hard-headed or stubborn and say, no, this is what we do and it's working, so we'll leave it at that. That's one of the things that Carmel had sort of their downfall over the years, going up and down, introducing progressive wines and then backtracking and doing something wrong. They made so many new entries into the market that even I at some point of time, I said, it's enough. Get it together and let's work, you know, at that point of time. But the credit goes really to the winemakers, all these guys that they were ambitious enough like we are, and they listened to what the people had to say, and they made their wines, and they do strive every day to make better wines for us.
So, talking about Israel, the wineries in Israel started at the end of the 19th century, first developed by the Rothschilds. However, instead of producing wines on the level that they were producing in France, because they knew the Jewish market, they were first producing very, very sweet wines. Little by little, that changed. Can you tell us something about it?
Well, they started with the sweeter wines because it's the easiest wine to make. You have to keep in mind that they were experimenting with new weather patterns, new soils and varietals that they was just started growing over there. That's why Israel has all these international varietals. So we always have the Cabernet and the Merlot and the Chardonnay and the Sauvignon Blanc, et cetera, et cetera. But they learn as well from their mistakes. So if you visit the Carmel Winery, they actually have a bit of a history to share on their, even on their basic tours, not even as a professional. And you learn that, you know, they learn from their mistake of having the fermenting vats outside that was too hot and their wine will turn into vinegar. So eventually they had them built underground and in the basement. It's a lot of years in learning. And it took a while for them to get there, but they reached the point of recognition. They reached of you know, making wines of international acceptance and awards, and nothing kosher is just an element that's part of the wine. It's nothing to talk about negatively. So it was a bit of an effort, and it took, if we say, when I believe Carmel was established somewhere in the late 1800s, 1880s, somewhere around
right,
there.
Right.
So it took practically, you know, over a century to get into the recognition that they have today. So I see the revolution. I see the revolution happening with my own country. We're still quite a few years behind, but we're getting there little by little. And for those of you who don't know, I'm from Cyprus, so Cyprus is not that far from Israel.
Israel.
That's why Israel, it became my adoptive wine country.
And I understand that the wine in Cyprus, unlike the rest of Europe, still tastes like it did hundreds and even thousands of years ago. Because in 1840, Cyprus was saved from the Phylloxera plague that killed all the vineyards in Europe.
Yep. We still have original rustic in Cyprus. But we're facing the problems that Israel experienced in the wine industry in the 50s and the 60s. You know, it works, so let's not change it. So it's getting there little by little. But we start seeing those little boutique wineries that the people are more ambitious and they don't want to sell their grapes to a co-op anymore. They want to make their own label. And it goes on. And you're aware that we actually had, and we still have, a kosher wine from Cyprus. We had enough
Zamburi,
of... Yes,
which you originally introduced me to, and it's an incredible wine.
It's an incredible wine. Unfortunately, we had one vintage in the U.S. market, and we never saw it again. The wine is still being produced, but not exported anymore. But for those of you, if any of you have any bottles still, the wine is drinking beautifully. We had it during last Passover when we had the last quantities left, and I tasted it just to make sure that
right.
The wine was holding up, and I was shocked. Well-made wine, it will hold, and it certainly is well-made, and it's holding up. I still have one bottle that I'm saving.
And not only that, it was also very, very reasonably priced.
Yes, it was. And with a lot of biblical meanings behind it on the and the label, right? So
right.
It in a way made sense, but not everybody, I guess, let's say the kosher market wasn't ready for a wine from Cyprus yet. It was easy for me to accept and sell because it's from my country, but I'm not U.S. I'm just one person in one store, and unfortunately I can do so much.
Right. Well, I am not from Cyprus, but I definitely like that wine.
Yes. For the ones
in Hebrew, the name was Yain Kafrisin, and
correct.
It was made from the same grape that used to be used at the temple in Jerusalem. In fact,
correct.
The good wine in those days was Yain Kafrisin, the Cyprus wine. And supposedly, this is the same grape as was used at the time.
Part of that wine was indigenous varietals, correct. It was indigenous varietals of Cyprus, you see. We have so many still indigenous varietals, original grapes that people are not aware of. And one of our mishaps is that they're not bottled as varietals. They keep doing what they did in the years past, blended with something. So and it becomes just another red wine from a country that half of the people don't know where it is. And why would I want to bother or spend my money? That's the major problem with our Cyprus wine industry right now. Other than that, we're doing okay. For those that they're willing to venture out, the wines are superb. And it's a new experience.
What was definitely an education for me is the first time I met you when I had that tasting. We opened up the bottle of the Lamburi.
Mm-hmm.
I tasted it, and at first I was not so impressed. You said to wait half an hour. I tasted it again, and I couldn't believe it's the same wine. Then we waited another hour, and I tasted it again. Then I was floored. It was an incredible wine. You taught me how to drink wine, basically.
Not only for that wine, but for any wine when you open it.
Right,
It is still, in a way, a living organism. So if you open it up and it's still tight and, you don't get the flavors, and you just let it sit for a while or decant it and allow it to breathe or use an aerator if you have one, which, by the way, without having anything to do with the brand, the Venturi aerator, it's the best wine toy that one should have, especially with some of the younger wines that we see in the market right now that require aging. It definitely helps open the wine instantly, no waiting required. The moment you use it, it's done, it's over. But it does open up. The longer you keep it, the better it will taste. And it doesn't really apply to every wine out there, but the majority of the wines require that. Some of the wines are more, go home, drink it yesterday. So they taste great, enjoyable, but nothing that it will improve that much to wait years for you to consume. In fact, some of them, they shouldn't be held for years to come. They are wines that they're meant to be drunk today. In a way, we have quite a bit of a variety, and in styles and in types of wine.
Now, let's talk about the various countries producing kosher wines. What about Italy?
Italy always had kosher wines, but they weren't always great. Most of the major companies in the market, which I know very well, and we'll talk or we'll taste together or we'll go back and forth with opinions. We tasted Italian kosher wines over the years many, many times, but none of them were really that great. And when you start configuring of what the wine should sell on the shelf, you say, okay, this doesn't make any sense. It doesn't worth $15. It doesn't worth $25. It's more of a $9.99 bottle. And the ones that were really great because of the limited production of them, and having the wine being kosher, the price was driven up very drastically.
Right.
So again, it made them unapproachable. Now, the Italians really coming around with all the grapes, all the varietals, and we see more and more. We had a Brunello this year. There is a Barolo in the works. I actually finally tasted the Partenura Ovadia Barbera. They make a Barbera di Alba.
I
was quite impressed. The wine tastes as a true Barbera. It has a nice bright fruit. In fact, it's a great wine to have for Thanksgiving table. And I do taste a little bit of Italian wines, and I see that there is no difference. If you blind test anybody between the Chiantis that we have in the kosher version and the Chiantis that we have that they're non-kosher, nobody will be able to say, okay, this wine is different, so this is the kosher one. So, progress, ambition, it makes the wines much better nowadays. And I will always say to people, if you don't know about the wine, try it. What's the worst case scenario? So you don't like it, you don't drink it. But venture out, get out of the monotony of drinking the same wine every day. There is so many wines out there right now from so many new wineries, so many new varietals to experience that if you're really a wine fan, you should be doing that. Not just sticking to the brand that you know for the last 20 years and I'm happy with it.
Two Saturdays ago, I was visiting some friends who would only drink sweet wines. I brought a mild wine, a dry wine, a semi-dry, and all of a sudden, they loved it. They didn't have all that sugar. It went perfectly with the meat. They loved it. It's only a question of trying it, educating one's palate a little bit, getting out of the ordinary. That's the pleasure of wine.
Correct. It's willingness. And even if you look what is available, you know, we do have the basic sweet wine. So if you want to graduate from that, okay, you know, you're no longer a teenager, so you want to start drinking a little bit of better wine. So you might go to a Moscato, which, by the way, Moscato is quite popular. Love Moscatos myself. Something in the afternoon in the summer for a glass of wine, it's perfect. As a dessert, we work perfect. As my regular wine, though, I want something drier. So you go from the sweet, you graduate to Moscato, then you could graduate to something more like what Baron Herzog introduced in the last 2 years, the Jeunesse series. So you get a real Cabernet or a real Pinot Noir with a bit of extra residual sugar. So you still get a hint of the sweetness to keep you happy, but the wine is still on the drier side. And then you have the next step, which will be the one from Winestock, the W series. It's sort of the graduating step going from the fruity, sweeter styles to going to the next step forward to the dry. So the moment you start, you know, getting into the W red and you enjoy that, but you're getting over it, then you're ready to experience the rest of the wines, what we consider dry. And trust me, there isn't that big of a difference in terms of residual sugar between the Red by W and, let's say, Weinstock Cabernet, which is their own wine. So even the wineries, they're trying to make the progression step. In their way, maybe they're thinking, okay, we cover every palate, or we'll educate them to graduate to what we consider dry wine. So it's a matter of willingness. That's how I see it.
Right, right. I remember as a teenager in my parents' house for Passover, for the four cups, we had these extra sweet wines. My father in Uruguay used to make his own wines because in Uruguay, just like the European style, lunch is the big meal, the big family meal of the day. And of course, you cannot sit down to a decent lunch. You cannot have a civilized lunch unless there is a bottle of vino on the table. Well, my father used to make his own wines. A couple of weeks before Passover, he would bottle 450 bottles, leaving one for us for every day, and give the rest out to some of the rabbis and a couple of close friends. So I was used to that extra sweet wine. Finally, when I came to the States, little by little, as other wines were introduced, I weaned myself off the extra sweet wines. And now, if I were to have them, I would get very, very sick. You can't handle all that sugar.
Well, you know, let's not, though, just since we're talking sweetness, I don't want anybody misunderstanding, you know, the traditional style sweet wine. And then you have this all these amazing dessert wines that they are sweeter. So it is, we're not talking, you know, beginners, it would be Concord grape, but then you have amazing desserts, which there, some of them can be quite sweet. And those I love, by the way. The more unusual they are, the more attracted I am to them. It's something that I love, and I will always taste. I never turn anything down just because it's sweet. So we all have that sweet tooth somewhere in us.
You turn it down because it's sweet.
Yes.
What I meant is wine that has been sweetened by adding a lot of sugar.
Oh, yes. Well, that is no longer wine. I wouldn't consider that wine
anyway.
The extra
sweet Malaga or the extra sweet Concord.
Concord, yes. That it is tradition, and it is great to use it during the holidays because it's part of the tradition.
Right.
But let's go up from there. Let's move on from there for everyday wine. That is something that if I see somebody is willing to move to the next step, I'll be more than happy to help them move to the next step with the right suggestions.
What are some of the top wineries in Israel?
Okay, so that top wineries, more innovative, I will say the bigger ones, simply because they have the money to experiment.
Right.
But we have so many wineries that even quite a few that they were in kosher 2 years ago, they have kosher wine in the market right now. And not necessarily being different, because most of them is still the Cabernet or the Merlot or the Syrah or the Pinot Noir. But you can still see the distinction. You can still see the passion in the wine. You can still experience the vineyard and what makes it different from everybody else. I can't say one winery is better than the other, because everybody has something great to my taste,
right,
and everybody has something that I personally don't favor, not because it's not a well-made wine, because it doesn't fit my personal taste.
Mm-hmm.
But I love them all. I will taste them all, and you know, you always get that one of the wines that it puts a smile on your face, and that becomes your favorite from that particular group, not necessarily your favorite winery of all. But two wineries that I always like to taste their experiment, that they're close to my heart, and maybe because we sort of grew up together in the industry, will be the wines of Dalton. Because Alex,
mm-hmm,
it's pretty much started at the same time that I started. And he's very innovative and adventurous. And
yes, absolutely.
Yes. And the wines from Tishbe. Golan is an amazing guy. He gets a little bit crazy occasionally. But I like the fact that he's not afraid to experiment. And he's
what
not
about somebody like Yatir?
Yatir, great wines, but you know, they found some wines that works for them, and they're sticking with it. They introduce something new here and there. It comes and goes. Quality is superb. They made a mistake 1 year, and their wines are way overpriced. And thank God, they learned their lesson.
Forest 2007.
Honestly, I don't remember what vintage it was, but it was at some point of time I had to sell it for like $125, which it was sky high. So the market didn't respond to that, and they realized that was unheard of, you know, unreachable. So the prices were adjusted by the next vintage. So if the cause was them being greedy or less production, whatever it was, the reasoning behind it, for one vintage, the prices were sky high, but they were adjusted immediately following with the next one. So the biggest problem, or not problem, but issue that we have with the Israeli wines, sometimes is the price differential as well, especially people that go to Israel often. And they say, oh, but I can buy this one for $40 over there. Why will I pay $55 over here? The problem is that there is three or four more people in between making money. There is transportation expenses. There is taxes. There is. Exactly. So the winery cannot adjust their wholesale prices that much to keep the prices the same in two different countries. As much as they would like to, I see it as impossible because they're literally going to have to cut their wholesale price in half for export for the price to be the same. Now, ironically, though, yes, I was speaking with Noam from Recanati a couple of weeks ago, and he was making exactly the opposite comment. He said, I can't believe it. You guys have our wines cheaper than we have them in Israel, in retail. I'm like, really? He says, yeah. I'm like, well, that's great news. So for one winery, we're in reverse.
What other countries besides Israel and Italy produce great kosher wines?
Well, the expanding markets right now or the new introductions are definitely Argentina. We're going to start seeing more and more coming out of there. Spain, we see more and more wines coming out of there. Australia
in Spain, besides Capsanes, is there anybody else producing kosher wines?
There is at least two other wineries because Capsanes is handled by one company, and then you have wines from Victor, that is a different winery, and then you have the import from Allied, that is another winery. So we have them, and they're all searching for more wines to extend their book. We're going to see quite a bit of more French wines coming in. I know Victor, which is represented by Teton locally, they're going to have new Burgundies and wines from Loire, and definitely a lot of Bordeaux coming into the market, and most of them affordable. So it's a nice thing. And as long as the market responds to it, they keep the selections larger and alive. But it's a matter of will the consumer respond to those wines. So we'll see how it goes.
Okay. What about countries like Australia and New Zealand? Anything there?
Australia and New Zealand, I believe, it for the time being, they've reached their plateau. I'm not aware of any new labels being introduced from there. We had extensions of labels. We have a couple of name changes, but the wines, they're still the same. So we still have, I guess, let's call it the leader. So we have Till Lake from Australia. We had Five Stones that it changed its name, the original Beckett's, if you remember that. Still the same one, or
right,
just a label change. There is extensions of that label. There is we had a new Shiraz introduction about a year and a half ago, but that was the latest. New Zealand, we had a new Sauvignon Blanc as of Passover, but primarily still Goose Bay. New Zealand is so far away, not so much on a distance. It makes it very difficult to keep to make the wines kosher because you have to fly the rabbis or the Orthodox Union from Australia to New Zealand for the wine. So it makes it so unbelievably difficult for them that nobody really wants to start that project.
I hear you.
So Chile is always going back and forth, but I like Chilean wines. They're always the bargain wine, or, you know, they're inexpensive. You need something basic for every day, or you're looking for a wine that it's a large party and you don't want to spend a lot of money. So Chile, it's always the value, which is true for non-kosher wines as well.
Okay. And thank you very, very much. As always, speaking to you is an education. In the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, if you want an education, if you want a superb selection of kosher wines and liquors, stop in at Gotham Wines and Liquors on 2517 Broadway, between 94th and 95th, or call them on the phone, 212-932-0990. You can also visit their website at GothamWines.com. Thank you very, very much, Kostas.
Thank you, Chaim. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure is all mine. And for the second half hour, we will be talking to five bloggers about Kosher Fest. What did we see this Kosher Fest that was different? What did we learn from this Kosher Fest? What did we discern about the future of kosher food in America? We will be joined by, in alphabetical order, Alessandra Rovati from Dinner in Venice, Esti Berkowitz from Primetime Parenting, Tim Amzalag, Director of Marketing for the Jewish Daily Forward, Roberta Scher from Kosherai, and Shoshana Raff from the Kosher Shopaholic. And the first one online is Roberta Scher. Good evening. How are you?
Good evening, Chaim. I'm great. Yes, I'm here. I'm great. How are you?
All right. What was your reaction overall to Kosher Fest 2011?
Well, I thought that it was a very exciting event. Each year it seems to grow and get busier, and there's so many people noshing and talking and crowding the aisles and looking for the newest in kosher.
What are some of the things that impressed you the most?
I would think that the newest and most unusual addition that can really work throughout the U.S. and other places is the new Manischewitz vending machine for hot foods. I thought that
Absolutely.
Was wonderful, because now people, even in airports all over the country, in hospitals, in institutional places, can have access to hot kosher food. So we were very excited about that.
What about the, some of the forums or the culinary Iron Chef type competition? Forgive my cold.
Those were fun. We always enjoy listening to the authors and the bloggers and seeing what new trends everyone thinks are happening in kosher. There's one thing that I found that's a definite. Kosher is growing. It's growing at Kosher Fest. You can see it at the fancy food show. You can see it in the supermarket. And that is the most exciting thing to me.
Among the new products, which ones will you be most likely to buy?
Well, I have to give a mention to Jack's. I buy it already, Jack's Gourmet Sausages. They have filled a niche in kosher that really hadn't been filled before. I enjoyed his new flavors at the show, but I enjoyed the flavors that they developed last year, too. I like the kosher sausages because they do not have fillers and nitrites and things of that nature. I also love chocolate. I'm a chocoholic. And so I found a couple of new brands of chocolate at the show. There was a Parisian, a French chocolate called
Michel Cuisel.
Yes, my pronunciation is not great, but I certainly love that chocolate. And then I am hooked to Schmerling chocolate. I eat it almost every day, because it's parve, it's delicious, and it's easily accessible. So I love the Schmerling.
Maybe in Atlanta. Here in Brooklyn, it's hard to get except around Passover.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah.
Well, we can order. I don't know if you're aware of something called the Kansas City Kosher Co-op. It's a service that delivers all over the country, and they deliver to Atlanta and many other cities, but they probably think Brooklyn doesn't need any help.
Well, you would have thought that, wouldn't you? But apparently, you do.
Right. So, and then the cheeses, Chaim. Oh, the cheeses were wonderful. Just,
oh, yes,
I
especially the Israeli company
Seiman
with all the European cheeses.
Yes, but that, cheeses are very difficult to get in many parts of the country. I don't know how it is in New York, but getting gourmet cheeses usually is a difficult challenge.
Yes, but with the Anderson International Foods, the label, the originally from Chicago, the label of the Sugar River cheeses,
mm-hmm.
made in Wisconsin, actually. These
right.
are cheeses that have won prizes in, you know, even in secular competitions.
Right.
And it was the best cheese of Kosher Fest this year.
Mm-hmm.
With that brand, their other brand, also non-Chol of Israel, Le Petit Fermier, and the Chol of Israel
yeah.
brand, Natural and Kosher, they are developing
mm-hmm.
some very, very delicious cheeses, both regular
yes.
cow milk as well as goat milk, goat cheeses.
Yes. I don't want to sound immodest, but Kosherai discovered Sugar River cheeses 2 years ago, and that was one of the first articles we ever wrote. We just love those cheeses, and some of the Whole Foods stores around the country does carry Sugar River.
Mm-hmm.
They're excellent, excellent.
I discovered them much later than you guys. I discovered them at the beginning, actually at the end of 2010, when it was still owned by Mark Rosen in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who sold to Anderson.
He
had problems of distribution. Anderson
mm-hmm.
picked it up, and they did something very, very smart. Mark Rosen was only selling it in small chunks.
Mm-hmm.
Anderson now has it also in slices. It certainly fits much better in a sandwich.
Right, right. I didn't even know that. Thank you. Now I'm going to tell you my number one favorite product I found at Kosher Fest. You ready?
Okay. Yes, sure.
It was vodka, Moses date vodka. It's Pesedik, good for Passover, and delicious. And I can't wait to get some bottles where I can create some recipes. Did you taste that?
Yes, I did.
And what
did
you think?
It was absolutely delicious. You're right.
It was different, and it's so hard at Passover to get good liqueur or vodka. Well, you can get some from Israel, but it's very difficult to find them, at least in the U.S. It's hard for us. So Moses date vodka was just exceptional. We loved the taste of it, and we plan to work with it.
Tell us a bit about Kosherai.
Kosherai was started 2 years ago by Lois Held and me. It was a reinvention of our careers. Lois was a technical person, and I've always been in retail and marketing, and I'm also a food columnist. And we decided there needed to be a website that reviewed kosher products, brought kosher products to the forefront, so that people would be aware of, number one, the importance of kosher, and number two, all the wonderful new products coming to market. And that's what we do. We look for the newest, we taste, we test, and then we write about them.
Okay, I understand that it's a reinvention of your careers, and I understand that you were a food writer.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you choose the subjects? Who is the demographics of your audience?
Our demographics truly are global, but I would say the majority is here in the United States, but we have people from all over the world. we're finding a lot of younger people are cooking even more and more. As you know, kosher consumers cook more than non-kosher consumers because they have
less
options. And so we're finding that we are very well accepted within the younger community. I would say most of our readers are ages 50 and under, and a lot of our young marrieds looking for which products are kosher, what's the best value, where to find them, and what to do with them, because we also share recipes. So we're just having a wonderful time because we're enjoying what we do, and I think people are really discovering new items.
Well, as Menachem Lubinsky said, most of the consumers of kosher products are not, unfortunately, us Jews, but there is a higher percentage of Muslims eating kosher because of halal, and
right. It's
also become trendy to eat kosher food.
Correct. The perception is that it's healthier for you and that there is a definite understanding of the ingredients in your food.
And finally, some of the other bloggers are starting to come on. We have one more online. They finally remembered. Esti, is that you online?
Yes. I'm sorry, I had some technical difficulties over here.
Ah.
Hi, Esti.
Okay.
Hi, how are you?
We're talking kosher. And kosher
fest. My favorite thing, I know, I was all prepared to give over what I really loved. You know, I had a lot of things I really loved about Kosher Fest this year, but I really enjoyed the Iron Chef competition. And
okay.
I know that Chaim had an active role in the judging of the competition.
Right.
And I really enjoyed just seeing what these chefs could do in a certain amount of time. It was actually, correct me if I'm wrong, was it 45 minutes?
45 minutes, and they found out about the secret ingredients 1 second before we punched the clock, before we started the clock. All the other ingredients were out there in the open, but they had no idea, other than the fact that it would be some type of meat, they had no idea what the secret ingredient was. What was interesting to me is how different the cooking styles of all the three chefs were, how different the taste was of the exact same basic ingredient.
Hi.
And I think Kim is on the line.
No, it's Alessandra.
Kim? Oh, Alessandra, I'm sorry,
yes.
I apologize.
I'm sorry I'm calling in so late. My kids were very hard to put to bed tonight.
No problem, I understand.
I blame it on them.
Okay, no problem.
I understand too, Alessandra, I know what that's like, so.
I remember what it was like. Now it's my kids have their own kids. It's my vengeance.
Now it's their problem.
That's right. So, Alessandra, what were your impressions of Kosher Fest?
I loved it. It was my first time there. I actually came looking for something very specific because I was very hopeful that I would find more Italian products at the, at the General Food Expo in D.C., this year, there was a kosher panel that was organized for an evening at the Italian Embassy they had speakers, including Rabbi Umberto Piperno, explaining to all these small Italian entrepreneurs, food entrepreneurs, what kashrus is and why it can be helpful for a company's business to obtain a hechsher. So I was really hopeful that more companies from Italy would come in, with a new hechsher and looking for distributors, but unfortunately, I didn't really see that, and I hope to see more of that next year. However,
as a matter of fact, 2 years ago, there was a small Italian pavilion, and I was hoping to see it again, and for whatever reason, they were not there.
So I did find.
I want to share with both of you. This is Roberta from Kosherai that we are in touch with. Hi, I'm here. The Italian embassy and the people that you saw, Alessandra, most likely will be introducing a lot next year at Kosher Fest. We're in touch with them, so there's some exciting things on the drawing board.
Yeah, I was also. I was just hoping for something, you know, already.
Yeah,
however,
not ready.
I did find.
So, ladies, which products were the most impressive, the products that you would be most likely to buy after having discovered them at the last Kosher Fest?
So, who goes first? Hello?
Hello?
Hi,
how about
it's Alessandra again. So, I mean, I was, I love cheese, and I was really, really impressed by some of the cheeses. There were both some great French and Italian cheeses that were imported. I think it was Seaman. You know, an import company. They had some really great Italian and French cheeses, including authentic kosher Parmigiano. And there's also local companies that are producing natural and healthy cheeses as well. And also I found some incredible gelato from Florida that I really enjoyed. And
yes,
I was I think it's called Don Petrini, the owner of the gelato shop. And then great breads, including, you know, the Tribeca oven. And I was happy also to meet with the guys from Cold Foods who produce meat and poultry that's not only free-range but humane in the way that, you know, the animals are treated. So there were also, I don't know if you guys agree, but there were also some very good products that were not foods. There was a packaging company called Premier, I think, that was eco-friendly, that makes a lot of, you know, baking molds, like recyclable, biodegradable paper baking molds and pan liners, which I love using when I bake. What about you guys?
Yes, I love those. Mm-hmm. Those were great.
Well, for me, my favorites were, of course, Jack's Gourmet.
Oh, they're so good.
Incredible. And, of course, Aura Tishby's Champagne Preserves, Passion Fruit and Strawberry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I am not a preserve person. As a rule, I do not touch preserves. Last year at Kosher Fest, however, I discovered Aura Tishby, love her offerings, and this year, once again, she won the best product in her class. Second year in a row, with new offerings. It's interesting that being part of the Tishby family, they mix it with wine or champagne as they did this year. Apparently, nobody ever, in the kosher world at least, ever thought of doing that before.
Right. Speaking of champagne, we had just a wonderful introduction of some French champagne at the blogger dinner at Solo. We're so sorry you missed it, but I know the champagne is worth buying. We had a new cuvée that just was made kosher, imported by Royal, called Champagne from Champagne Drapier. I guess I'm saying that correctly
Drapier.
In French. It was spectacular, and I look forward to buying it to have some at home. What did you two ladies think?
No, the champagne was really great. I enjoyed it. I also would have liked to taste some of the wines at Kosher Fest, but to just like the idea of tasting wine at, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, I didn't really do it. The champagne we had at Stroller was fantastic. I didn't want to drive back, you know, too happy.
Well, every time I tasted some food, I would go and wash out my mouth with some wine. Happy Hearts had a nice selection of wines between their Bravdo, Copage, with their Namura. There were some very nice wines that they had there.
Mm-hmm.
But so
also,
nice, you can order
also their
wines.
Brunello di Montalcino.
Mm-hmm.
A superb wine that you could say it's a great wine in any case that just happens to be kosher.
Mm-hmm. There was, I also saw a product that I was very interested in that was looking for a distributor. There was a Japanese company that had brought rice bran oil. I was particularly interested in this because as an Italian, you know, often some types of regional Italian cooking are not very spicy, and we really use the main ingredients, you know, including like the oil is also seen as a flavoring agent. And, of course, when you are parv, you run into this situation where the dishes that are too delicate to be cooked with olive oil, especially in the case of desserts. I don't particularly like using seed oils because if it's not good enough to dip bread in it, I don't think it gives a good flavor. And so I experiment for bacon with coconut oil or peanut butter oil, and especially for frying sweets for Hanukkah, you know, some people don't like the flavor, the aftertaste of olive oil for frying desserts. And I thought that this rice bran oil was really delicate and delicious, and they say it's very healthy as well, and I hope they find a distributor for it. The company was called Suno, and they came from Wakayama, Japan.
Talking about oils, there were some very good Argentinian oils in the Argentinian pavilion. And in fact, an Argentinian wine won the prize as the best wine of Kosherfest, best new wine of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was produced by Marumatok, and it was a Cabernet Sauvignon Malbec. Malbec is the quintessential Argentinian grape.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have a distributor in the U.S., Chaim? Do you know if they have a distributor?
They have a distributor in Miami, and they were looking for a distributor in New York.
Mm-hmm.
The Marumatok wines are very, very reasonably priced, very, very good wines. In fact, the Argentinian terroir is considered good enough that the Rothschilds, for the first time, ventured out of France. They ventured out of France before when they went to Israel in the 19th century and again in the 20th century. But they had never before gone to South America. They are now in South America producing some superb wines in the real French tradition, the real Rothschild tradition. Like Fecha de los Andes and so on.
What
now,
else did you... Oh, did you... Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I asked if... Did you see... I just saw Levana's blog or newsletter. She reviewed that challah mold, the silicone challah mold.
Mm-hmm.
I thought
that
was a very interesting product. And there was like a huge debate... you know, like her post was followed up by, it stirred a debate on Facebook about whether, you know, it's appropriate to cut corners when baking challah. I thought that was very interesting. Some people feel very strongly about it. They thought it was immoral to try and make it easier.
I remember a year ago I had a professional baker do a series of articles on my blog about braiding a six-strand challah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, quite a few people wrote me that they did it. They sent me photographs,
mm-hmm.
and they actually looked beautiful, those challahs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know somebody, for example, my co-blogger, S-Y-R, who used the mold, cutting the corner,
yeah.
as you
what
say,
did she
and
say?
You couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. And, you know, even somebody who can braid the braided challah, they may have one day when they're making a 12-course meal and, it, you know, it can come in handy.
Well, it's
to have
like
something
a bread
that helps
machine.
To make it quicker.
Right. It's like using the bread machine
yeah.
or doing the 5 pounds of challah. When you can't do the 5 pounds of challah because of time, this seems like a wonderful
right.
shortcut.
I agree.
Absolutely.
So
I
agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're
and
going to
Susanna
be
Ralphie's on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Good evening, Susanna.
Hello, everyone. I'm sorry I'm joining in so late. It sounds like I missed
Hi,
a lot
Susanna.
Of fun.
Yes, it is fun.
So you're talking about my favorite topic.
So what were your favorite parts of Kosher Fest?
Oh, my favorite parts of Kosher Fest. Oh, I loved all of it. I think I'm putting a lot of faces to names. Definitely the cook-off. That was so much fun. I think we should do a lot more things like that. we should have some live cooking shows and lots of cook-offs in the kosher world. That was so much fun. And we can figure out a way for everybody
fact,
in the audience.
It's being planned already.
Oh, excellent.
And I will have details over the next
it?
Couple of weeks.
Wow.
What's
as a matter
that?
Of fact, I will have details over the next couple of weeks of the cook-off coming
about
up.
Another big cook-off?
Yeah, with professional chefs, restaurateurs.
Excellent, excellent. That is so much fun. Just being there, smelling it, and watching it, it was so
mm-hmm.
exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know what the whole rage is in the in like on the TV in the mainstream world. You see how it was really great. And you know, I guess you know, sampling the new products, I loved the Ayala's sparkling water. That was really
yes.
an excellent product.
Yes. They are still looking for a distributor though.
Really? They're still looking for a distributor.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed real beans. It's so wonderful. You know, the Starbucks, well, I guess it's just nice to have a Chal of Yisrael version of something very similar to the Starbucks Frappuccinos.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then meeting people like Noreen Gillett, Are you on the phone from Kosher Eye? Are you still there?
I'm here. It was a pleasure meeting you
so,
as well.
It's such a pleasure to meet you. I met, it was a lot of fun also when we had the panel, the cookbook authors panel, getting to ask them questions and hearing them talk, and you know. And it was very cute because I met Paula Scheuer for the first time. And she was sitting right in front of me, and I was posting on Facebook the whole thing about the cookbook panel, and it was also on Twitter I was posting it, and Paula Scheuer tweeted back to me. She said, "Where are you?" And I'm sitting right behind you. So it's a lot of fun when you have the whole social media piece live right in front of you.
Right.
We got about 90 seconds. We've got about 90 seconds to go. So let me ask each one of you if you have any comments about the different cooking styles of the three chefs that were in the competition.
Hi, this is Kosher Eye, and I had to catch a flight, so I wasn't there for that part. Lois was, and she's not on the line.
Oh.
I didn't really... From where we were sitting, I think it was very hard to see or really tell anything about different cooking styles. We didn't get to taste anything. It was hard to really see up close exactly what they were making or any of their styles. It was, it was cute to see them talking to themselves. It was cute to see, like, some of them had, like, a lot of steam and moved really quickly and others moved very slowly. But I wasn't really able to tell any difference because it was very hard to see and we obviously didn't get to taste anything. How about you? You were a taster.
Yes, I did. And I was able to get very, very close. I was impressed by the difference between the three, the difference in taste in their dishes, and specifically the difference in the way they worked. For example, Craig Solomon, at moments as he was moving the pan, he seemed like a ballet dancer. Very precise, very elegant move, and the dish that he made, also, the presentation was superb. It was an architectural masterpiece, the way he did it. Chef Moshe, extremely imaginative, using very exotic ingredients, like amba, which is basically an Iraqi mango pickle condiment. I had never seen or heard of it before, but it made the whole dish. It was incredible. And then, of course, Chef Warshaw, of the three, he appeared the coolest under pressure, even though he said later that he never thought he was going to win. He thought they were going to completely trounce him.
Maybe he had sampled a lot of the wines at the Recanati stand.
Okay. Any parting thoughts from any of you ladies?
We look forward to an even bigger and better Kosher Fest in 2012.
Yay.
Amen.
Yeah. Same here, but I hope we all get together before that. Maybe we can get together at one of these big cook-offs.
Absolutely.
Well, next stop for us is the Fancy Food Show in Washington.
There is also going to be one here. Okay, Alessandra.
Exciting.
Okay, and we're just about out of time. Thank you very much, ladies.
Thanks for hosting time.
Thank you,
Chaim.
Thank you
so
much.
Thank you, Chaim, for having us.
Great hearing you all.
Good night, one and all. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in to us. And next week, come back for another exciting show. Good night.
Good night.